morning. This is my name is Kirk, and I'm here with Scott. Craig couldn't be with us today, but for this observation segment, we're delighted to be here. And how are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well. I'm excited for the history lesson today.
Okay.
I actually am. I've been thinking about it all week.
It's the exciting stuff. It's exciting stuff. It can be a little dry, as history can be, but I think what our motive, you know, for doing this whole thing is that it's to prove that we can trust and rely on Yahweh and the Torah. And even though the world's view of sequence of events from many historians like the Egyptologists is not the same as the Torah. However, what we did find and what I found is that the history from all the ancient historians, non-Hebrew, tell the same story. We found that in the past. So what I'd like to do to get us up to speed, though, before we jump into the next segment, section three, which covers really what happened after the Exodus, after they left and after Egypt began to fall and to ruin, before we get to that, we need to kind of get up to speed because it has been a couple of weeks since we did the other program. So if you'll allow me, I will go ahead and kind of cover that. Is that okay?
Yep. That's why I'm here. So, yeah, okay. Definitely.
So what Scott and I examined last time was the 10th plague. And, of course, that covers Pesach and Passover. And the descendants of Abraham, you remember, placed the blood of the lamb on the doorpost and of their homes. And then when the 10th plague hit, which was an earthquake and possibly in conjunction with a Moloch, they didn't harm. What happened was that the people that had the mark, the blood on the door, were saved, and the people who didn't were destroyed in large numbers. It happened very suddenly in the middle of the night, and we covered that in great detail. The slaves weren't harmed, but the firstborn in particular of the Egyptians were killed. Now, we did have the question that came up, and we covered this a little bit. If Yah just used an earthquake, there would be an indiscriminate killing, and the temples and the palaces would suffer to the extreme, and therefore Pharaoh's son or Pharaoh's family, for that matter, a lot of them could have died. Now, what we found out was from Iporah is that indeed Pharaoh's son was killed, thus fulfilling the prophecy that the firstborn of Egypt would all be killed. It doesn't have to be, however, every firstborn son of every family, although when you have such a massive killing off of the upper crust and the people who lived in these temples and lived in the palaces and stone buildings, then an earthquake without any rebar and stuff is pretty much going to collapse and kill an awful lot of the inhabitants. And then we debated on what the Torah actually said, which was covering the on page sixes. If we've actually published, somebody has taken my notes and put them on some of the websites, so you can follow along a little bit better that way as well. But what we went over was the prophecy. And did it really mean the firstborn of every household, or could it be the firstborn of the choices of the land, which would be Pharaoh's son? And that's debatable, but it really doesn't matter because we do know that Pharaoh's son died, and also that most of Egypt was in turmoil and quite a horrible catastrophe. So we had the slaves left Egypt. And they were ushered out by the Egyptians. They were paid off by the Egyptians. They gave them gold and silver and anything they wanted. Please leave after the 10th plague. And however, the Pharaoh did change his mind, and he pursued them, and then he caught them at a place called Pi-hah-Keroth. And we discussed that a little bit. And unfortunately, what happened, or fortunately for us, unfortunately for them, the Egyptian army was caught in a whirlwind at the Gulf of Aqaba. And that's why we could place it there, because that's what Pi-hah-Keroth is described as a place at the Gulf of Aqaba. So we found that to be true throughout the Torah, and that the Egyptian army was wiped out. Then along came the Amu, that's the Egyptian name for the Amalekites, and that's a name for king shepherds, and they came from Asia, or sometimes they refer to it as Arabia. And they marched on Canaan, Syria, and they split into two different armies when they heard about Egypt, and they sent the other half of the army down there to Egypt to see what was going on, and they found out that they were in Rern, and they took over. And they reigned there for about 400 years, which we'll find out pretty soon. And these same people initially were frightened. Some of these people, some of the Amu that were traveling north from the peninsula of Saudi Arabia, and we'll find out why they were on the march, because they experienced the same type of catastrophes that happened to Egypt and most of the Middle East. This was not a, as you know, Scott, this wasn't a minor little thing. It happened to the whole region. And a lot of people were destroyed by these earthquakes, and all the tornadoes. This terrible catastrophe, and they were, and the Amu were on the march. And we're going to find out a little bit of history of those from the actual historians of the Arabian world.
By the way, something that I find kind of funny. What do we call tornadoes and earthquakes?
We call them
acts of God.
Yeah,
they're acts of God.
and it's a natural occurrence, but these were massive. I find it odd that it seems to be hard. Let me just inject something here for a second. Thinking about that is these big catastrophes. If you remember the story of Noah, the thing that wiped out the Middle East to begin with was an asteroid strike. This is a major monumental event, destroyed that whole Middle East. And the culture that grew up after that from the descendants of Noah's family, some settled in Egypt, and of course that became the Egyptian nation. And as that culture came up, this terrible, terrible sequence of events, cataclysmic events, destroyed that culture. Along with most of the Middle East, we know it also affected the Minoans. It wiped out Knossos and Crete on Crete. And it's almost like people don't even think, they write it in history books where it doesn't even, it was a minor little event. This was a major, major, major event. And so the contention was that if these things actually happened, then they would have been recorded by everyone that every group that still had enough people left to write something down, and that's what we actually found in Apura. He recorded everything exactly on all the scroll that we have left. He recorded everything exactly as in the same sequence even that Moshe did. So that was pretty outstanding, just fascinating. So the Amu, which is the name that the Egyptians called these people who invaded them. The question became, and we asked last time, on who they were, why they were, or where they came from, and what importance it was. And the other question would be, well, how long did they stay? And apparently they were there for a very long time, which you cannot find in modern-day Egypt chronology. But hopefully today we'll get to the point where I can show you where, just like a little equation where you have A and C, A plus B equals C, and you have A and C, you can figure out where B is. We'll figure out what parallels we have, and you'll be able to put the chronology back in according with the Torah. I'm sorry. Yes, sir?
The Pythagorean theorem, I believe is what it's called?
That's a little more complicated than this. This is a simple algebraic thing, A plus B, and then if you have two numbers, you can figure out the third number. And that's about as simple as it takes once you have a firm fix on when the Exodus occurred or how many years we have. We'll go with the Torah numbers, and then I'll show you where they have the Egyptian history is all confused. Now, just for those listening, the evidence that we used so far, we were using the Torah with a accurate, obviously we need an accurate English translation, but we're very fortunate with CW being able to do that, and then a lot of us now have figured out how to also check that and see and make sure that we're all correct, so we have good English translations for the first time in history, I think. We used Apura, who again was the one of the priests in Pharaoh's house who recorded all this information, and we used papyrus 116b that's in a museum in Russia, and the El Ardish stone, which also gave us tremendous amount of information on the Amalekites. We also used, if you recall, we had Manetho, who was, even though his information, all his histories were the Greek, were in Greek and are not extant, Josephus, the Jewish historian, he wrote it down. He made a copy of Manetho's, and so we have his information as well. Then we used Griffin from Antiquities and William Flinders Petrie, History of Egypt, and all sorts of inscriptions we found in that they found in Egypt, and Ginsberg's legends and so forth and so on and so on. So we answered all those questions with overwhelming evidence on what happened verbatim. And we discovered that the Amu, the king shepherds as they're called, are the Amalekites. And they probably were from Esau's grandson, Amalek, and that's where they got their name. But they were also called by the Greek historians Hyksos. And also, or better, another way of pronouncing it would be Hyksos. And they ruled for about 400 years plus. And if what we will prove today is that it they ruled from the time of Moshe, Exodus, all the way to the period of Dode. At that time, just to give you a brief forward, going forward, we're going to find that there were two empires that emerged and flourished at the time of David after the Amalekites were destroyed. So what we want to do now is head on and get some more information from a different source, something we haven't done before. And these are the Arabian accounts from Arabian historians, and some of these names you might even know if you read Prophet of Doom. It's a whole other body of evidence. So the upheaval, now we're going to take it from the view of the Arabian Peninsula and the actual Amalekites. We're going to use Abu Farajad, who was a historian in the, at the tail end of the 800s BC, before the Common Era, up to the, I'm sorry, half in the Common Era, 800 to 967 is when he passed away. In his Kitab al-Aghani, forgive my pronunciation, which is called the Book of Songs, he wrote, "The traditions report that the Amalekites violated the privileges of the sacred territory," he's talking about Arabia, "and that God sent them ants and forced them from Mecca. And afterwards, their Lord sent drought and famine and showed them the clouds of the sky on the horizon. And they marched without rest to those clouds, but they didn't reach them. The drought was at their heels." And he was talking about their destruction as they tried to get escape all the catastrophes that were happening in Arabia. "And all the tribes reported horrifying experiences along the way of the 1,000 miles of the Tihama coast," which is the coast of Arabia. Masudi, who lived in about and reported about the 9th century, or I'm sorry, the 10th century, the 900s, he relates that the tale of the catastrophes were swift clouds, ants, and other signs of the Lord's rage. Omiyah, son of Abu Salt, and I know this is a little dry, but let me get it all out because the gestalt comes from an overwhelming amount of evidence reporting the same conditions and the same events. He's from a tribe of the Taqif, and he reports violence, flood carrying all of them away. The Arabian traditions that also survived to our time from the 9th to the 14th century report that after the Amalekites invaded Syria and Egypt, they established a dynasty of their pharaohs, Amu pharaohs, throughout the land. And that was from al-Samhudi, also in the 9th century. The Amalekite king, El-Widi, son of Duma, arrived from Syria, invaded Egypt, conquered it, seized the throne, and occupied it without any opposition his entire life long. That was from the Arabian historian Masudi. Now, if you recall, last week we covered Apura, who said exactly the same thing about the condition where they came from, and that they had taken over without opposition. And the first king, which we'll later know be known as Apophi I, he took over, and there was no opposition. Why do you think there was no opposition, Scott?
Were they gone?
Well, no. There's no one to oppose him.
Yeah,
when he takes over Egypt, Apophi I, there's no enemy there. is there in Vern. The people, there's thousands and thousands, if not millions in some cases, that are all passed away, have been killed in all these catastrophes. And the king, and the Pharaoh, rather, he took off chasing Moshe, and what happened to him?
He was also, he found an unfortunate end.
Yeah, he came to a very unfortunate end. That's what Apura also reported, as you've called. So there's nobody there to, there's nobody there to confront him.
Actually, I take that back.
Took over.
He got what he deserved.
Yeah.
He got what he deserved.
Yeah. Well, the parallel there, of course, and is that if the one thing that people have in common, like with Egypt, and unfortunately we do too, is we have a great army. We don't seem to care much about the Israelites. We don't treat them well, and we support their enemies. And that usually comes to no good. And we'll talk about that perhaps at the a little bit towards the end of this on the parallels of this story versus our future story, because there's a catastrophe coming in our plans as well in our prophecy about our times. Now let's go over to Manetho, as cited by Josephus again, and he said that the Hyksos savagely burned the cities, razed the temples, or razed the temples of the gods to the ground, and they treated the whole native population with utmost cruelty. It sounds kind of like modern-day history to me.
Yeah, are we talking about today's news, or?
Yeah. Well, the parallels are pretty scary. The parallels are absolutely pretty scary. Now, Masudi agrees with, I'm going to go a little bit further now. Masudi agrees with Queen Hatshepsut. Now, there's an inscription found in Egypt by the queen who became Pharaoh, and she had a brother or a son, I'm not sure which, but who also ruled with her, who took over later. And this is much later. This is a contemporary of David and Solomon's era, which we'll prove in a little while. But she wrote this story. She wrote on, now this is on a large wall in Egypt. Once again, all we're trying to prove is from every different source that these are the events that were recorded there in Egypt in regards to the Exodus. Were provable. These things actually happened. Everyone recorded exactly the same events, and you piece enough of these information together, and you get the idea that obviously there was an Amu. They did come up. They did take over. And the reason we're hitting it kind of strong is because most of the history books don't give any credence to this whatsoever. However, everybody else seems to in the ancient world. And Masudi said, there had been Amu in the midst of the delta and in Havar. Havar is also Avaris, also now known as El Arish. And foreign herds of the number had destroyed the ancient works, and they reigned ignorant of God, of the god Ra. So they were now obviously reigning. Now, I don't know how Masudi, I'm sorry, that was not Masudi. That was on the inscription of Queen Hatshepsut. But what we had just done is over previously, which said Masudi had said basically the same thing. And Apura even mentions it as well. So we've got three different sources talking about the same thing, proving once again, or recording that the Amu have shown up and taken over. Tabari, which I'm pretty sure Tabari is one of the historians used in the Prophet of Doom historians, he said, then the king of Egypt died, and another king, he's talking about now the Amalekite king. The king of Egypt died, another king, his relative, ascends the throne, and he was also of an Amalekite race, and was named Kabus, the son of Mosab, the son of Nimar, son of Salwa, son of Amon, and son of Amalekite, or Amalek. So they trace the history of all these kings that ruled all the way back to Amalek. Now, according to Manetho, that's back by the way of Josephus, he described the Hyksos invasion of the country, destroying, burning, raping, ravaging, and they established a dynasty of Hyksos pharaohs. The first king pharaoh, Manetho says, was called Seleucus. Remember, he's writing in Greek, who resides in Memphis and exacted a tribute from Upper and Lower Egypt. So he was in control of the whole place and left a garrison in place most suited for his defense. In particular, he secured the eastern flank to protect him from the north. Now, the reason he's needed to have a place of protection there is because the Pharaoh's army may have been wiped out, and they may be controlled in Egypt, but what is north, the last power that's left of any consequence, is the Assyrians, and they will come into play many, many years later. But he was smart enough to build a post called Al-Aresh to defend his newfound empire that he's just taken over. He was worried, King Seleucus situated a place called, this is once again, this is the from the historian Josephus, the King Seleucus situated a place called Avaris, and as a strategic point from which he could control both Syria and Egypt. The fourth king, and let me back up here just a second about the kings. Depending on which historians you read, there were four kings who are four pharaohs, Amu pharaohs, or in some of them they say there were six. There was quite a few because they ruled for many hundreds of years. So I'm not sure about that. But we do know, we have enough information to know that Apophis, who was the first one, and there was Apophis the second, was the last one, and then we have a few mention of some of the others in there to put all the pieces together. But basically, those were the key players.
Did you
and
say
the fourth
Apophis?
King, once again, he says, is called Apophis. And he would have ruled for 61 years, so he was a long-time king. Now, that is boring as all get out just reading that stuff. However, I'm going to put all the pieces for you as we keep going, and you're going to see where all these little dots connect. Apophis.
Real quick.
Yes, sir?
Is Apophis spelled the same way as the meteor?
Yeah, it's a god of horror, god of destruction, is what the word means. And Apophis is, to them, the reason they would have called him that is because these people were destructive. I mean, if you recall, they came in and they raped everybody, killed everybody, enslaved everybody that was left. And they tortured people. And we're going to cover some more of that in just a minute, too. So these were bad, bad news people. And when you talk about a meteor that's going to hit us, amazingly, is that what you're referring to, the connection there?
Yeah, that's
the
yeah,
meteor
that's
coming.
Yeah.
It's called
Apophis, right?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
And not only in the Torah is it called that, it's also called that by NASA.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Who is tracking it, by the way, and has unlimited sources of income to produce some way to knock it off its course if it comes too close.
Give it that little nudge.
Uh-huh.
Which I believe is also in the Torah. I believe it's a nudge, correct?
Yes, it is. So, wow. There's further evidence of Apophis being around because they found scarabs or official seals were found throughout countries with his name on it, King Apophis, or King Apop, without the I for some reason, engraved on the Sphinx in Babylon. They found them in jar lids in Knossos in Crete. An inscription of Apo says his father Seth, lord of Avaris. Now, it's important to know Avaris because that's the same name for El-Arish, which is the place where he built this outpost to protect him from any Assyrian attack, but he could rule most everything all the way to Syria to the bottom or the upper Egypt, the southern part of Egypt. He says the Lord of Avaris has set all the countries under his feet. So that's the way he's described. So he obviously had a swath of territory. There's absolutely so much information and so much evidence, it's hard to put it all together, to be honest with you. So I want to ask a question. Did Israel know of the troubles of Egypt after they got out? And the way we could answer that is, well, there is a good answer for that. In Psalm 78:49, Yahweh talks about this invasion, this 11th plague of Egypt. And he said that Yahweh says he cast upon them fierceness of his anger, wrath and indignation, and troubled them by sending evil angels among them. Now, that's the English translation. So I'm going to take a little pause here a minute because, after all, we are trying to confirm the Torah here. on Psalm 78:49, on most English translations, can't seem to get it right, they refer to evil angels. Yahweh doesn't have any evil angels. Evil angels don't work for Yahweh, and he don't send them. So I went back to the Psalm 78:49, and I did my usual thing of looking up everything I could possibly find. And what you'll find that when he says, God says, he cast in on them the fierceness of his anger, his wrath and his indignation, and he sent trouble. Now, that's a word. The word for trouble is to sar, which is an adversary, which means adversary, not just trouble. Trouble is the English word, which should be translated as an adversary or a foe, which could be an angel. He said, by sending, which is malakoth, from the word shalak, is the base word of shalak, and that word means to send a human subject. Malak's ain't human. So we could translate it that way just as easily. And then it says, and trouble by sending destroying messengers. And that's where in the English it turns into evil angels. Destroying could be bad, could be evil, miserable, and so forth. But it also can just be a evil days of trial and hardship. It can be a band of destroyers. A band of destroyers could easily be the Amalekites. And then the last English word that's translated is malak, which is messengers. But messengers, as we all know, can be what we refer to as angels or malak, or they could just as easily be King Popey. The messenger who walks for another doesn't have to be an angel. It could be a man. Yahweh just doesn't have evil angels. So to me, it's a slam dunk. He's talking about Yahweh's telling them in the Psalms that he sent evil messengers and just let them at it. Now, thank you for that little aside. But back to the Torah. The books of Joshua and Judges cover over 400 years of history. And interestingly enough, there's not a single mention of Egyptian domination of Canaan, nor any Pharaoh military expedition. It's because the Hyksos were the dominant empire over Egypt, all the way to Syria, all the way through Arabia, and all of Canaan. Here's another clue to prove it. You remember who Balaam is? The one who, sorcerer, prophet, the Baal's prophet? Does that name ring a bell to you?
Baal obviously rings a bell, mm-hmm. But...
Well, Balaam was his prophet.
Okay.
And if you recall, there's a story where he has a... where he's struck by light and he's in his donkey talks. Anyway.
The donkey talks, yes.
That's the guy, yeah. Well, the donkey done. An angel, a malak, actually talked through the... or Yahweh talked through the donkey to him. So that's the story that you always get in the Sunday school. But here's what Balaam was a big player in this, in Numbers. And Balaam said, he was a sorcerer, he's Baal's prophet, and he was called on by the Amalekites to curse Israel. And normally you would think that was what he'd be doing, but he doesn't. He actually blesses them. In what we refer to as Numbers 24:7, Balaam says, his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag. Also known, Agag is another name for a Popey, and his kingdom shall be extant. Now he's talking about the Israelites. He is blessing them, and Agag is a Pharaoh. If he was a little two-bit player, then if he was some type of Egyptian, we would know it. But we know that Agag is indeed an Amalekite. So he's not talking about an Egyptian pharaoh. In Numbers 24:20, he goes on to say, and this is once again Balaam, and he looked at the Amalekite, or Amalek, and he took up his parable, and he said, Amalek is the first among nations. Now, the first among nations indicates to me that he would be a higher, he would be a big deal, he would be the ruler both over Egypt and Canaan. And then it goes on to say, in Numbers 24:20, but his latter end shall be that shall be that he perish forever. If you're going to compare somebody and praise somebody about something, say, I'm going to be greater than, or you are going to be greater than so-and-so, it has to be a major player. So it's obviously referring to the new people who are running, the Amalekites who are running Egypt, because that's the only power source left. Then we find in Judges 12:15, Pirathon is the land of Ephraim and the mount of the Amalekites. So everything through the next 400 years of Israel's history, the opposing or the enemy is Amalekites. Doesn't matter where you go, it's Amalekites or Amalekites association with someone else, like Edomites or whomever. The Amalekites were supported by the Canaanites, and the Midianites were actually not just supported by, they were controlled by the Amalekites. They were still ruling from Avaris. He had quite an army. In the conventional history, the Egyptians were the power, not the Amalekites. But the Amos are not Egyptian, nor are they a small little Bedouin tribe. Let's go to Judges 6:3-6 and have another encounter. This was encountered of the Israelites. This is interesting because this will tell us about the Amalekites. This defines the Amalekites by their war tactics. In Judges 6:3-6, it says, and so it was when Israel had sown, planted their seeds, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites and the children of the east, and they encamped around them, and they destroyed the increase of the earth till they had come to Gaza. And they left no substance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. They took everything they had. Now they came up to their cattle, came up with their cattle, rather, and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for a multitude. I mean, we're talking a huge, not only a huge army, we're talking a huge amount of cattle. For both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land, and they destroyed it. And Israel was greatly impoverished. I bet you Israel at this point, now this is post-entering into the promised land. This is in Judges. They were called king shepherds, and the cattle and the camels without number. They would drive the cattle before them to devour the harvest, and then take and steal away the oxen and use for plowing every other animal they owned. That's an amazing tactic, and they did that in Egypt, we found out, and I'm going to read that for you in just a minute. They would take all these herds. Let's pretend you're a farmer, and you just planted all your seeds, you got your harvest ready, and you want to go get your harvest. All of a sudden, they come on the horizon with thousands and thousands of cows, and they have a stampede. You ever seen a stampede?
I have.
You get out of the way.
Yep.
Yeah, this is. I don't care. A few bulls will scare you. A whole stampede is.
Well, you watch it from a distance.
So what they would do is, and they did it a lot apparently. Through all these historians report so, they would drive these cattle down to these farmers. The farmer's trying to save his crop. He can't get in there to do anything. It's dangerous as all get out. You get in front of the stampede and you'll just get run over. The cows all mingle and start eating all your crop, and while you're trying to do something, and number one, you're a farmer anyway, the army comes in behind that and just wipes you out. That's a tactic by the Amalekites. I don't record anything. I don't find anything else where anyone else did it that way. Let's go to Judges 7:12, and where Yahweh talks about that, and they said, they and their cattle compared to grasshoppers, and as to the sand of the seaside. They did the same thing, by the way, in Egypt. In Papyrus Emeritus 1116b, on the front page, recto means front page, of that papyrus, so I've got some other stuff on the back. The Amu approached in their might and in their hearts, raised against those who were gathered in the harvest. This is in Egypt. And they take away their kin or their ability to plow. The land is utterly perished, and nothing remains. That's from Gardner's translations of the papyrus in the Hermitage. Now we'll move on a little bit more. All we're trying to do is establish that over all these years, we're dealing with Amalekites. King Apophis II, Agag the second, or Agag the second, is the last of the Amus that ruled Egypt. So now we're going many hundreds of years in advance. He sent a messenger. This is an interesting little thing. He sends a message to, sent a messenger from Avaris, which is El Arish, which is their home base, with a humiliating demand to the Egyptian prince Sekhenri. Now, the reason, only reason that's interesting, we're going to find out that how did they also rule. It gives us another little insight into the Amus ruling Egypt. They were smart enough to know that they were the terror, they were the horror, but they sent a whole bunch of Egyptian princes in charge over regions, and then they were simply controlling much the way Rome did when they had a governor or they had a local king or whatever. He would continue to rule as long as he would pay homage to the Amalekites. And this is a little insight into that. And on the Solara Papyrus first, we have, now this one is, some of it is destroyed, but here's what we do have, which is kind of interesting. The prince of the southern city of Thebes remained silent and wept for a long time, and he did not know how to return the answer to the messenger of the king Apophis. The prince was arrested. This is continued on with the papyrus. It says, the prince was arrested by a messenger and brought to Avaris, and the rest of the scroll, unfortunately, is unreadable. They ruled with Egyptian princes, ruling their own little kingdoms there and reporting back to them, and then they would pay them tribute. What I was trying to establish in putting this information together was that the place that they control this outpost, this fort, was El Arish or Avaris. There's a tremendous amount of information that the major outpost of the Amu was indeed El Arish. They have found that it was a place that had over 250,000 troops and everything to support, train, feed, and serve those troops. And it was a vicious place. When they did some burials, when they dug up some of the burial grounds, Scott, what they found was they excavated and they discovered that they had heads, arms, and lots of dead animals. All the things that you will read about them were in that place was that this was a vicious place. And this is where they were sending where they were calling for the prince to return to. So obviously he had made somebody mad, because we never hear from that prince again in any history that's written that we can find. And that's why he's under great distress. Now, Apophis II, let's move on now. We're moving down the history chain a little bit, and I'll put it all in order for you after a while, I promise. 1 Samuel 15, 2 and 3. This is where Samuel says to Shaul, remember Shaul the king, King Saul? Thus says Yahweh, I remember that which the Amalekite did to the Israel, and how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite the Amalek, and utterly destroy all of them, all that they have. Shaul gathers 200,000 footmen, plus 10,000 of Yehuda. And then we move to Samuel 15:5, 1 Samuel 15:5. And Saul, or Shaul, came to the city of Amalek, and laid wait in the bed of the Shredim, or Nakal. This would be the Wadi River, which is right below El Arish. This is still in the region. This is not in Egypt. It's in the Sinai, but it still would ultimately be controlled by Israel as part of their land. So he's going down there to fight the Amalekites. The Wadi is of El Arish is also, by the way, dry in the summer. And if you read that story in the Torah, you'll find that they waited out in the dry riverbed. Yah never sent, that's just my little aside here, Yah never sent Saul to destroy the Amalekite in Egypt. Once El Arish fell, then the Egyptians destroyed the Amu that were left in Egypt. In Samuel 15:7-8, as we continue, and Saul smote the Amalekite from Havilah until thou comest to Shur, that is over next to Egypt, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. This is contrary to what Shaul was told by Samuel. What did he tell him to do? He told going to wipe them out. Saul has let the Amalekite alive. He's let the king go. According to J.H. Bristed, the ancient records of Egypt, the Solara Papyrus records the same event where instead of the pharaoh of the Egyptian prince, a pharaoh or an Egyptian prince wins the battle, the one, they call it the one translation, or the foreign liberator frees Egypt. The foreign liberator who frees Egypt was Saul. When he destroys that El Arish compound, then they have wiped out the remainder, the biggest part of the Amalekites' army. So now we've moved all the way up to Saul, and this is the end of the Amalekites. But unfortunately, Saul has done this terrible thing. Before attacking El Arish, Saul made an agreement with the Kenites, which are affiliated with the Amalekites, and that's the king. They were allowed to escape while under siege. In 1 Samuel, Yahweh records exactly the same thing. He says in 15:6, and Saul said to the Kenite, "Go, depart. Go down from the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. And the rumor had it, because we can't prove this, but it's pretty obvious in a minute, the rumor has it that they escaped to either southern Palestine, where the Philistines were, or to Arabia. Now, there's one more event we want to cover, and then we can start working on a timeline to see where we are.
Either one of those
during
two
the reign
places.
Of Saul pursued the Amalekites, and he destroyed Ziklag. This is 1 Samuel 31-3. And he found an Egyptian that was there serving his master. Well, Egyptians don't serve anybody's master according to modern history, but obviously he's serving his master, the Amalekites, according to David. And David rescues the woman, the women and the children because they'd just taken over a Israelite town. But once again, it shows that the Amalekite ruled over the Egyptians. It also shows that the Amu invaded the south of Palestine. So now we know we can connect the dots there, and now we know where they went. They didn't go back to Arabia. They went over to Palestine when he let them go. Why? Y'all don't want them in Palestine. He wanted to wipe them out. That really gets Yahweh upset, and Samuel is the one who eventually kills Agag, or Apophi the second. Shaul falls into disfavor, and as you recall in the history, Shaul gets killed in a battle. Dod and Joab and the king, and by the way, King Amos, this is significant because we're going to look at that timeline in a minute and put everything together. Dod and Joab and the king, Amos, besiege Sheruan, which is the small town left of the Amalekite that ran away. It took them 3 years, though, and then they destroyed it. Now, two cultures grow from this, two great cultures grow from, and two great heights from this, from the demise of the Amu. These were vicious people. These were not people of letters. These were not people who built great temples. They built nothing. They destroyed everything. They just lived off of the slaves. Egypt and Israel under Dod, David, and then under Solomon. Unfortunately, Jeroboam, I'm going to give you a brief history. Jeroboam, who is the son of whom? He's the son of Solomon. He went to Egypt. He ran away during the reign of Solomon, and he lives in Pharaoh, and he marries, I think, Pharaoh's daughter. And he and his wife wind up ruling the northern kingdom of Israel, and they adopt paganism, probably because he was down in Egypt. He loved Egypt a lot more than he loved the Egyptian gods, a lot more than he loved Yahweh. But they never had to deal with, after this event, they never had to deal with the Amalekites again, unless you believe the Amalekites are a culture, like we find in Islam. Now, I want to look over, here's what you're going to find when you history, so we can put it all together. Everything that Yahweh said in his Torah can be proven. He wasn't writing the history of all these people, but it was interesting that all these people actually record the same thing. Unfortunately, when you get into modern history and archaeologists, Egyptologists, they have numbers all over the place. Scott, if I was writing a history of the United States or of the North America, and I'm recording a particular time on a timeline, and I'm writing all about Columbus discovering America, and you're using that same date, but you're recording 400 years later, you're recording maybe something in Queen Victoria's era, you can't match it up. So it looks like one of us is lying, or one of us is very confused, or we don't know what we're doing. So it's very hard to, if you believe one over the other, it's very hard. What you do is you discount the other, and that's what they've done with the Torah. If you think, we're absolutely certain that around 450 BCE, before the Common Era, that the Exodus took place. Egyptian history records the ones that are most important to us in the stuff that we were just reading, is we have Amos the First. Amos the First was the first Egyptian pharaoh after the Amos were destroyed. Amos the First was the Amos who worked with David and worked with Joab when they conquered the last vestige of the Amos group. So if we know when Dode was, then we know who Amos was. But if I look in an Egyptian history book, I've got Amos the First living in 1549, during which is 100 years before the Exodus. And then if we have Amenhotep as the king, which is contemporary to contemporary after that, and then we have Solomon come along. So we have Amenhotep, we have Thutmose the First or Thutmose the Second. We have around 1479. So we've got all this Egyptian history, hundreds of years. These people have been gone for 400 years by the time we get to David and Joab and Saul. And then we've got this story about a king named Solomon. And he builds a temple. And he's wise, and everyone comes to see him from all over the world, known world at that point, right? They all want to visit and see. They want to see this great temple that he's built. And it's supposed to be silver, but they had unbelievable amounts of silver and gold and all kind of things. He was also a biologist, you know, a botanist, and he had trees brought to him from all over. He also builds Solomon builds on the Gulf of Aqaba, where he lays a stone that says this is where they crossed. He builds a harbor. Now, while we're thinking about that, think for just a minute. We do have a history of a lady called Hatshepsut, which is a hard thing to say. Hatshepsut, sometime without the T. She would have to be the one that they call the Queen of Sheba. Number one, there's nobody who is a Queen of Sheba. She was a little bitty Arabian town, and she wouldn't have made a big stir if that was the one who came from. But we do have a woman who happens to get, who is the queen or the pharaoh of Egypt, and she's a contemporary of Solomon in the real timeline. And we know this because she writes about this journey that she goes on when she goes and builds a navy. We have reliefs in Egypt that show all the stuff that she took on these ships to go visit some king. Now, the whole world has been destroyed because of the Amu. There's nowhere for us to go, so you have to conclude, you have to think a minute. She's not going through the Delta and heading off to Crete, because there's no Crete has been destroyed. It's not a big place anymore. There's no great culture there. She's probably not going to go to Syria. Babylon is nothing. And then there's nothing down in Africa to rival what she would be doing. So she's building a navy. She built this navy, or at least these ships, and she's loading them with all these gifts. And she heads off, and that would be the only way that would have been safe for most of those people to go through and go all the way to Jerusalem. And then you go by land from there. What we have there is all the things she recorded, not only the things that she took, she recorded all the things that some great king at a place called Kodesh, very interesting, Kodesh, as you know, means to set apart. And so she goes to this place called Kodesh, Jerusalem is called Kodesh, the set apart city. She goes there, she meets this wise king, they probably have an affair. She has all these gifts that he gives her, And there's only two cultures after the Alamo that can possibly thrive, and one of them we know is Egypt, and the other one, of course, is Israel. And she records all this stuff verbatim, and if you look through Chronicles and Kings and so forth, it's the same stuff on the wall that she shows pictures of that he gave her, that he records that he gave whoever this Queen of Sheba is. I find that remarkable.
That's awesome. I think that's awesome.
That's pretty awesome stuff. Now think about this. Had Shepsut, I have to be careful, she would have visited, they have her down in Egyptian history. Go pick up an Egyptian history book, and it's going to say 1479 to 1458, and she has a son, by the way, which is going to come into play here in a minute. She is a powerful, powerful queen. She has access to a whole lot of stuff. And she would have had to have lived around 960 if she was going to visit Solomon. And it's a slam dunk she's the one. So now we got to move her down to 960. So then we have Thutmose, and then we have the Amenhotep, and then prior to her we have Amos the First. Now Amos the First, we already have him being the one, being contemporary of Saul, or contemporary of at least Saul and David, and that puts him at 1013. And we know Saul was about, 1053. Dode is 1013. And then we have Solomon takes over in 973. So if we put that together, and we know Amos is him, and there are no Egyptian kings before them until you go all the way back to the one that was conquered, that was destroyed in the Gulf of Aqaba. Now you can realign your history, and all of a sudden now the Torah makes absolute perfect sense, and now Egyptian history makes absolute perfect sense. Now Hatshepsut had either a brother that was a co-ruler or a son who was a co-ruler. I've read different things, but basically there's a male who was a shadow. She only ruled for about 20 years. And in addition, her son, which is Thutmose III, he takes over after her. Now, there is a king in Egypt, that Jeroboam. You know, Jeroboam now is one of the two sons, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Or Jeroboam. Jeroboam took over the northern kingdom of Israel, and Rehoboam took over Judah. That was when, it was after Solomon's death, that the two parts of Israel are divided. Now we have two countries, northern kingdom and southern kingdom. Jeroboam, we know, left Israel for Egypt before his father Solomon died. We also found out that he was given a wife, the Egyptian wife, by Thutmose. He returns after Solomon dies. He returns with an army, and he becomes a puppet leader over there. This is when Egypt invades Israel. And they take Jerusalem, and they sack the joint. They take everything that Solomon had, everything in the temple, and they take it back to Egypt. Those are chronological events happen in certain dates. We know those things happened. These are contemporary people, and we're told what the names are and what kingdom they are. They're recorded in Egypt. They're recorded in the Torah. It shouldn't be that hard for somebody to put it all together. Now, let's think another minute. Now, we'll go back a little bit further just to show you something else that's really quite interesting. I'm not sure how our time's coming. Are we doing okay?
We have about 5 minutes.
Okay. Let's talk about Jericho. In Jericho, you know, the trouble with the story about Jericho is in modern history, if you use the Exodus in the days of Ramses, which is far, far later, if you use that day as your date when they left in the Exodus rather than in 1450, then there is no Jericho there to find. What they find, scientists and archaeologists place the Egyptian catastrophe about 1450 and the final destruction of Jericho at or about 15 BCE. And that's the end of the Middle Kingdom. So that That's fine. Now, we know that that's when it happened. Jericho evacuators found that the city had been repeatedly destroyed, that the great wall surrounding it fell in an earthquake shortly at the end of the Middle Kingdom. Now, that was after they dug it up. There's nothing on top of it after that. So the only way that that story could be true for Jericho to fall and would be in the trumpets blowing would have to be in the between 1490 and 1500 BCE. And that's from the story of Jericho by Garthang and the two Garthang brothers that were historians. If Jericho, if that happened, then now we can place Joshua, or Yahusha, be technical, at that site at that time. And it would have to be at that time to have an earthquake that big to destroy it, because there aren't any earthquakes that big, really, again, that are destroying whole cities like that, that they were during the time of all the great catastrophes. That was another earthquake after the fact. As we who live in California know the earthquakes, and then you can have another one coming later in the, until everything settles out, and you can have really powerful earthquakes after that. Schaeffer, in the Strategies, he's a French historian, he found that the same story at the same timeline in Troy, in the Nile Valley, Anatolia, the Tarsus, Syria, Ugarit, Babylon, Persia, Mesopotamia, the Middle Minoan Age of Crete, and all the way through Europe, even to the Indus Valley. Even the Hindus on the Hindu culture were suffering from the same tragic events. So what we know, what we do know is that if you take the time, as Velikovsky did, and as so many of these, so much of this evidence that we have now, if you take the time to put the history together, you'll find, you'll be very confident to know, if you like what it says in the Torah, you'll be very, very, very confident to know that these things actually occurred the way they happened, when they happened, and you can find corroborating evidence everywhere that it is indeed true. So you can, if it's all about trust and relying on Yahweh, I can tell you that's important, because we're in the last times, last days. When Yahweh says in Daniel and Isaiah and so forth, Yahshua, these things are going to happen, and this is when they're going to happen. Believe me, you can bank on it. The Exodus story, as we come up to Passover, is probably, we should conclude with this, the Exodus story. And that of the Amu and the Hyksos and the Greeks and the Amalekites in Hebrew really tells us a tale of a monumental misuse of what is one of our greatest gifts that Yahweh ever gave us, and it's called the Nesama. The Nesama is the ability, obviously, to use your brain to reason between those things that are good or tob and beneficial, functional, and raw evil, the things that are destructive and dysfunctional. When Adam and Shawah produced children, they produced one of their sons, of course, was Cain. Cain was asked with his brother Abel to come back and share and have Passover with Yahweh. That's why they were there. Cain, in his own divine wisdom, decided, I don't like the deal. I don't want to tell that story. I don't even like that story. I'm going to bring my vegetables or whatever. Abel, of course, brought a lamb. It wasn't the first Passover. I think the first Passover was Adam and Shawah. When they killed the lamb, they probably had a feast. He wrapped them with the clothing that was available after the lamb. Perhaps that was the first Passover. But this is the first one that makes sense in detail, in that they were asked to come to a designated place at a designated time and have a designated menu, because Yah was about teaching us what he wants to have a relationship with us and what is necessary for you to benefit, and what things not to benefit from, and what things not to eat. So the metaphors were all there. And that was a Passover meal that we'll have to continue some other time.